Hello, it's Tuesday 21st of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bauerman from Check In Asia.
On today's show, we're taking on one of the biggest issues in global tourism, the future of cruise travel.
It's a big task. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thank you for listening in. So today we've set ourselves a rather large challenge, as we're asking, what is the future of cruise travel in Asia Pacific in general, and Southeast Asia in particular?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. If you remember, Hannah, a few weeks ago, I said to you that cruise marketing was the second hardest job in travel right now after promoting the Tokyo Olympics. Well, those games have come and, well, they haven't come, they've gone. They're shifted into 2021. So cruise marketing, I guess, must now be the toughest job in tourism. We look at the troubles that cruise ships have had worldwide during COVID-19. Some perhaps not their own fault. Some of the ports have made it quite difficult for them, but there have been huge, huge challenges. So the challenges for the cruise industry are global, but we're going to focus on Asia, the whole of Asia Pacific, largely because some of the popular itineraries in this region combine elements of Northeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and of course, Southeast Asia.
They do. So let's start by name checking some of the top cruise hubs in Southeast Asia. Obviously, number one is Singapore, which is the region's primary cruise port, both because of its strategic location and excellent infrastructure. So Gary, let's run through that list we created. And obviously for some of these destinations, cruise ports are slightly outside of the city, but that's how they're advertised. So in Malaysia, there's Penang, KL, Kota Kinabalu, Langkawi. Indonesia has Jakarta and Bali, and Thailand's top hubs include Bangkok, Koh Samui, and Phuket.
Yep, and in Vietnam, we have Hanoi, Ha Long Bay, Ho Chi Minh City, and Da Nang. The Philippines, obviously, is a vast archipelago, but cruising tends to focus there around the capital Manila, Puerto Princesa, and Boracay. Yangon was, pre-pandemic, starting to attract quite a few ship calls to Myanmar, and Cambodia counts Sihanoukville as an emerging hub.
Well, that's a pretty good list to start with. But before we look ahead, let's set the scene a little bit about where the cruising sector found itself before the outbreak of COVID-19.
Yeah, it's, 4 months now. We live in a very different world than we did back in August 2019 when the managing director of the Cruise Lines International Association, Australasia and Asia, said, "The popularity of cruising in Asia is expected to grow further over the coming years as cruise lines deploy new larger vessels that have been purpose-built for Asian consumers." He added, however, that growth has been rapid in recent years and that a 5.7% year-on-year decline in passengers was expected for 2019.
That's interesting, a decline. But despite that slowdown, there's still been 79 ships from 39 cruise brands calling at 306 different Asian destinations in 2019, which is an increase of 18 destinations from 2018. Of those destinations, India, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong, and South Korea were all predicted to experience growth.
Yeah, here in Southeast Asia, cruise lines were starting to put in place the infrastructure to build the sector region-wide. As we mentioned in our hub list there, Hannah, you know, most countries in the region have cruising hubs now. The exclusions, I guess, are Laos, which is landlocked, and Brunei, which hasn't really tapped into this yet. But last year, Royal Caribbean signed a 3-year partnership with the Singapore Tourism Board and Changi Airport, which was projected to bring in around about 623,000 fly cruise guests between 2019 and 2024. Those guests were hoped to generate over 430 million Singapore dollars in visitor spending.
So that's a pretty big number.
It's a huge number, yeah.
Yeah, and just last December, the CEO of the world's largest cargo port operator, Global Ports Holding, told Bloomberg that Southeast Asia will become a very important cruising region. Draw a circle around Singapore and you've got an area that's as big as the Caribbean. We want to open more transit ports there by adding new destinations or even converting container ports to cruise terminals. I mean, and cruising is massive for the Caribbean. So if the CEO of the world's largest port operator is saying that Southeast Asia could be the new Caribbean in terms of cruising, that's really big.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Caribbean is sort of, well, began as the world's cruise hub, really. Americans take a huge number of trips there every year. I think alongside Europe, those are the two major global hubs at the moment. But Southeast Asia and obviously the rest of Asia Pacific has been growing pretty, pretty fast. So that brings us up to the start of the COVID-19 crisis and the issues of stranded cruise ships, which were pleading with the ports around the world, not just in our region, to allow them to dock when passengers on board and crew members as well fell sick. These so-called floating Petri dishes were widely reported around the world as the port authorities and local health systems were put under huge pressure to allow people to come onto land. Now, some of those cases in Japan, Australia, Cambodia, Florida, California, we read all about those. They were big, big stories. And then just, what are we now? Just over a month ago, on the 10th of March, Singapore allowed the Costa Fortuna cruise ship to dock as part of a scheduled call after Thailand and Malaysia had both turned it away. I think Malaysia had actually banned cruise visits by that.
Yeah, I think so. I think Malaysia were one of the earlier countries to actually do that.
Yeah, they really were. So the travel industry predictions for 2020 in all sectors now are in complete tatters. We've had such a disastrous first 3 months. The focus obviously is on healthcare and saving lives rather than travel and tourism. But the Cruise Lines International Association had made some predictions for 2020 and how the industry could have panned out under normal circumstances. So globally, 278 cruise ships were set to sail this year, including 19 ships that were debuting in 2020. But despite the promise of future growth, the numbers for Asia were predicted to remain relatively small. Some 4.2 million of the predicted 30 million global passengers this year were projected to originate from Asia. And I think around 2.5 million of that 4.2 million was from China.
Wow, so that doesn't leave much at all for Southeast Asia. I mean, and actually, if you look at Mata Fair, which is the largest consumer fair in Malaysia for travel, last September, there were cruise lines everywhere. The same when I went to the Thailand International Travel Fair in January in Bangkok. Again, cruise lines, both river cruises and ocean cruises, everywhere. So you can see that they're really making a push towards Southeast Asian travellers to attract them to cruising.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it was becoming an emerging sector, wasn't it? It was getting a lot of coverage. There were a lot of ships, a lot of new ships specifically for Asian travelers were being pushed into the region. And the big cruise operators, obviously the cruise industry is dominated by a number of big players, really did start focusing on Asia because although, as we said there, the numbers were relatively small, they did see potential for huge growth.
Yes, but saying that actually only 5% of the world's cruise ships were deployed to China this year, 5% to the rest of Asia, and 5% for Australia, New Zealand, and Pacific. So, you know, COVID-19 aside, cruising in Asia is still a long way behind North America and Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that reinforces the point, as we just said, you know, it's an emerging sector, but there was still a lot of promotional work to do. But as we said, you know, these statistics count for very little right now. There's no cruising going on. Virtually all cruising is ceased around the world. And ships are either docked in ports around the world or they're just idling at sea. And in some cases, they're actually being used. Singapore had suggested using them for quarantined.
Yes, for quarantine patients and their foreign workers to really accommodate that massive boom in cases that they've had at the moment. It's quite an interesting use of cruise ships at any rate.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we are. I mean, this, as everybody across the travel and tourism sector is attempting to uncover sort of hidden avenues of growth for the future. Primarily at the moment, the focus is on domestic tourism, and hopefully in the not too far distant future, we'll be looking at international travel again, although that at the moment is pretty unknown. Cruise tourism therefore faces a tough turnaround, both in terms of the operations and the public perception regarding health and safety.
Yes, and I mean, what has been really interesting is that even over the past couple of weeks, we've still seen the cruise industry really pushing its PR with articles promoting that bookings are up in some areas of the world for 2021, although it's pretty hard to gain a global picture on new bookings compared to trips postponed from 2020. A report in the LA Times newspaper suggested that cruise bookings are 40% up next year and that 11% are actually deferred bookings from 2020.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's hard to get a very, very clear picture at the moment. It's still pretty murky. But on the other hand, to the LA Times report, there was an online survey of 5,000 people by the Independent newspaper in the UK, its travel section, which revealed that 30% of respondents who had previously taken a cruise said they would not currently consider cruising again. And that's quite an important factor because cruising does have a very strong and loyal following. It always has had, especially in the US and Europe and now hopefully in Asia as well. If sort of experienced cruisers are starting to consider whether they will cruise or when they will cruise again, that could be a big issue for the industry.
Absolutely. So shall we discuss some of the key issues that are facing cruising in the region?
Absolutely. Yep, let's start.
So I think the biggest one really is safety and security, both for the passengers, but also for the crew. You know, what is going to have to happen so that passengers and crew will feel safe setting foot on a cruise ship again?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting issue, because when you look at some of the big stories that we've seen over the past few months, so the Ruby Princess in Sydney, the Diamond Princess in Yokohama, these stories are about ships that have patients and crew on board that have contracted the virus, and obviously the virus has spread quite quickly because you're in close quarters. There has been some issues about whether the segregation was that great, but we don't really know until the inquiries are held on that. But the cruise ships also have the problems that when they come to port, they've actually been turned away. So that's actually exacerbated the problem, because, you know, once you've got people on board and you've got such a virulent disease as this, it's gonna increase at quite a rapid pace with so many people in such close quarters.
Right. And you even have Gunting Cruise Lines, who've said this week that they're going to be implementing a lot stricter health screenings. So doing infrared temperature screenings, pre-boarding health declarations, you'll need a doctor's certificate if you're over 70. And that will become mandatory for all its cruise ships. And I can imagine that this will be rolled out to other cruise liners as time goes by.
Yeah, and beyond cruising. I mean, this whole debate about the future travel and safety and security is going on right now. You know, the airlines at the moment are talking about, you know, will they have to actually not sell some of the seats in between people so there's actually space for distancing between people. You know, some of these QR code apps, will you need those to actually board a flight or to get on a cruise? You know, what's going to happen in terms of antibody testing? There's a lot of confusion around that right now. But there, whether you're on a cruise or whether you're going on a cruise ship or you're going on a flight, or even if you're on a train or whatever, you know, there is going to be a huge issue of public safety and health, and people are going to be very wary, I think, of getting too close to unknown risks for the foreseeable future. So I think all elements of passenger transport will have to take these very, very seriously, and crews, obviously, because you're on board the ship for such a long period of time.
Yep, and of course there are so many people from so many different countries on board too.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of churn of passengers through different cruise ports. Yeah, that's a very good point.
So, second, will cruise operators be more cautious in restoring ship calls so there is less cruising?
Yeah, well, I think that there's that issue. And then will we actually start to see smaller ships? You know, over the last few years, we've seen this sort of huge rise of the mega ships. There's the cost of Venezia, which was launched last year in Asia, and specifically for Asian passengers. It's an Italian-themed ship, and I think that's got over 5,000 berths. So you could have 5,000 people on a ship at any one time. Now, you know, these ships were built for projected growth, but as we've seen this issue of health and safety and you know, the viral issues come to the fore, and we said in our previous point about passengers feeling safe and secure, I don't know whether you'd feel more safe or secure getting on such a big ship or even a smaller ship, whether there would be much difference. I mean, that's going to be an issue I guess we'll see pan out in the coming months.
And if you look at Carnival, it's even said that it is expecting a worst-case scenario. And for its upcoming 18 new ships that they had ordered by 2025, it said most of these new builds might be delayed because the shipyards currently are closed. I mean, and it's a good excuse to also reevaluate the possible demand as well right now.
Yeah, I mean, measuring and predicting future demand patterns is a really tricky thing across the whole industry, across all regions of the world. And the cruise sector is, you know, that's a very high profile issue for them because, as we said, their ships are so large, the running costs are so huge just to get those ships into sea, and they spend so much time at sea. They employ, you know, there are issues about wages and employee conditions, but they do employ a lot of people. So, you know, what's going to be the issues there in terms of how can cruise lines actually sustain their businesses, especially if demand is much, much lower? We really don't know, I guess, on some of these questions at the moment, and we're probably going to be maybe asking ourselves the same questions in six, eight, even 12 months' time, probably.
Yeah, I'm sure. The third issue, bookings. Do we think that there's going to be huge discounting going on? You know, with anyone who's looking at cruising, waiting for the best deal?
Yeah, well, we've started to see a bit of movement on this. So I got a press release this morning from Silver Sea Cruises, and they've been running a Cruise with Confidence campaign for all the reasons that we've been saying, trying to, you know, generate some security and some safety for travelers and to get them feeling, you know, that they want to cruise again. So they're saying that anyone who cancels a cruise with up to 48 hours notice will receive 100% credit for a future cruise that will be valid for 2 years. So, you know, they're actually going to be looking further ahead than probably the airlines are right now. They've also said that on those deferred or even cancelled bookings that the travel agent commission will be protected. But probably the most interesting thing is that they're also offering up to $1,000 credit to spend on board for bookings made before June the 30th this year. So that's clearly intended to try and drive up bookings in this uncertain period.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of credit, isn't it?
It's a huge amount.
It's a smart way of doing it, isn't it? Rather than discounting the price, you're adding extra credits. And then that will inevitably be spent on ship as well. So you're kind of keeping that money there. And actually, it's quite similar to what I saw a few five-star hotels doing during that kind of domestic tourism phase of coronavirus, where they would not offer discounted rooms, but they would offer lots of additional services that you could get in-house.
Yeah, that sort of campaigning has sort of suffused into the hotel industry over the last year, 2 years, I would say, simply because of the level of competition and also the competition from the home sharing. So whereas the hotels were pretty reluctant to draw back on rates, but so they were offering, you know, these extra incentives in terms of spendable credit in restaurants or at spas or, you know, in room dining or whatever, just to, you know, to boost up the value of the package rather than actually dropping the price. Where we'll be after COVID-19 on that, I'm not sure, because I think, you know, there could just be a free-for-all in terms of price discounting, and the danger there is it's just a rush to the bottom, and, you know, that won't actually help too much on hotels or cruise companies in terms of their high costs.
Yes, and if you look at travel agents, and in Asia, I would say that people are still pretty traditional in the way they're booking. Many are still booking via agents. If you have big cruise companies who are discounting, they're not going to be offering these travel agents that same level of commission that they would normally get on a full price cruise. So it's going to impact their margins as well.
That's a good point. I mean, that's a very essential point, because that's knock on through the whole industry, the whole chain, isn't it? You know, that it will affect everybody. So, Hannah, I'm going to ask you the fourth question that we've come up with. And that's, it looks like that around the world, different countries will come out of COVID-19 at different rates, whether that's just domestically or even internationally. So when these countries come out of this at different rates, will they start accepting cruise ships at different rates, or do we just have to accept that maybe they won't accept them for the foreseeable future?
Oh, it's a tough one again, isn't it? I think a lot of it will come down to regions and regional cruises. So, for example, if you have cruises between Australia and New Zealand, perhaps they have an agreement between those two countries that travellers can travel between them.
Yeah.
And perhaps we might see that in Southeast Asia. So we might see Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, who have all got their borders open to one another. Hopefully, we'll let passengers travel between those different points on a cruise. But we might not see cruises being open, you know, places like Cambodia or Myanmar, where the healthcare systems are a lot more precarious.
Yeah, I mean, this issue is going to raise big issues for the cruise operators to actually plan their itineraries, because if you look at some of the cruises in our region, Southeast Asia, they tend to stop at, you know, several different ports, several different countries. Some of them go to China, Korea, Japan. Often they come to or from Australia, New Zealand at the time. So, you know, if some countries are and some countries aren't allowing cruise ships, the whole itinerary structure is going to completely change.
And of course, it's not only what countries these cruises are coming from, but also what nationalities are on the cruises too. So they might just have a blanket ban against, let's say, New Zealanders. Unlikely, I think, because New Zealand is holding it so well. But it could be they could decide no New Zealanders. And then how do you handle that? Are New Zealanders even allowed into the embarkation point in the first place, and so on?
Yeah. And as we said earlier in our discussion, Hannah, you know, Singapore was really, really promoting the fly cruise. So people fly into Singapore, use Singapore as a base, spend some time, you know, traveling and enjoying Singapore, then getting on a cruise and going around Southeast Asia or wherever. You know, that there's an extra issue there, because you've got Singapore's got to actually allow people in first before they can get on the ship to go around the region. So extra complications.
Absolutely. So that brings us on to the fifth issue, demographics. Is cruising something that will ever appeal to Gen Z and millennials?
That's an interesting issue, because globally, the loyal cruise base tends to be slightly older. I mean, that's a generalization, but the figures tend to bear that out. You know, Asia region, we do have quite a lot of aging societies in our region. There's no question about that. I worked in the US after 9/11, and the cruise industry obviously was one of the sustaining forces in getting people to travel again after 9/11, because Americans were very fearful of traveling overseas. But there were the issues at that time that cruise ships were seen as a potential terrorist target, you know, a floating terrorist target. So a lot of work was done during that time to try and develop the themed cruising aspect, you know, so you don't just aim at the traditional cruise market. You actually produce a lot of shorter cruises, sometimes even 1 or 2 days weekend cruises aimed at a younger audience. So you bring in elements of music and entertainment and that kind of thing. And that sort of industry has really, really developed over the last sort of, couple of decades, I guess, in Europe as well as in the US. And it was starting to make a little bit of a splash here in Asia, but it was very, very sort of low key. I just wonder whether that's the only real way that they're going to target millennials here in the region, because the issue of safety and security, I think, will be strongest amongst that sort of demographic.
And of course, you do have lots of shorter cruises here in Southeast Asia. So 3 days, 4 days in Singapore, out of Phuket. And those kind of shorter cruises, like we were saying, can attract millennials and Gen Z who don't have a lot of leisure time. You know, they don't have 2 weeks to travel around and who want to try out cruising. It's a good step to do so.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And so the sixth question, I guess, is one of the biggest, and that's the issue of sustainability and environmental protection. You know, will the world simply have moved on from cruising because of its impact on the seas in terms of pollution, discharges, fuel usage, and also this element of flash visitation? So big cruise ships arrive in port. A lot of people disembark. They don't really spend too much time in port. Quite controlled in terms of where they do and they don't go. They don't stay in hotels because they sleep on the ship. They don't tend to eat in that many restaurants because they eat on board as well. So you kind of have a lot of visitation, but in terms of the amount of spend you get for that visitation, sometimes it can be quite low. So that's also sort of feeds into this sustainability issue.
It is, and I think it will be really interesting to see how destinations and cities decide to handle this. Will they decide to impose high port fees, for example, just to really try to discourage, you know, this kind of flash visitation that you were talking about, Gary?
I guess globally, Venice and Dubrovnik are sort of cases in point for that. That's where we've seen a lot of backlash from ordinary people against the just so many cruise ships that come in during the cruise season, which is, you know, tends to be spring and summer. So it's a relatively short period of time and you get just so many cruise ships coming in.
Yes, and they're not really contributing anything. So this might be the time for cities to finally stop and reassess what value cruise ships is actually bringing to their city.
Yeah, and then back to the actual ships themselves. I mean, I don't know what the development is of zero emissions vessels or if that's even possible, but I picked up an article that was published yesterday in Splash magazine. Now, that focuses more on the actual maritime trade, but there was a very interesting quote in there which said, before the COVID-19 crisis began, there was a creeping realization that reducing emissions for shipping had to happen and fast. Now, that obviously is focused more on the maritime shipping, but it does apply to cruises as well. You know, the seas are being polluted at a very high rate.
They are. And at the opposite end, you know, of these massive vessels is river cruising. And that has really flourished in the past recent years, especially, you know, the luxury upscale travel segment. So we have seen a lot more luxurious boats, for example, on the Irrawaddy in Myanmar, between Yangon and Mandalay, going along the Mekong Delta in Vietnam, and also Cambodia to the upper reaches of the Mekong. Even earlier in the year, boutique river cruise operator Heritage Line announced the launch of a 10-berth ship called Anuvong, named after the last Lao king, that would offer trips to the upper Mekong River in Laos. So this is really great because it gives an opportunity to some of the more developing countries in Southeast Asia, like Myanmar, like Laos, like Cambodia, to explore the country in a different way.
Yeah.
And I would say that a lot of these more upscale river cruise operators tend to focus on more community activities. And because you don't have that distance to travel, you know, typically when you're on a river cruise, you get off in that city or destination itself. You get to spend more quality time there as well.
What's your experience, Hannah, in terms of the booking process for river cruising in this region as opposed to cruise booking? Do some of these boutique river cruise operators, are they direct booking or do they book through agents or is it a mixture of both? Do we know that?
Well, from personal experience, I would say that it is predominantly through agents.
Yeah.
I mean, river cruise operators, of course, do have their own websites. You could book on them. But because it's such a high price point, in general, they prefer to book via an agent because they just feel more secure. You know, they're not putting down $4,000 on a website. They've no idea if it's legit or not.
That's absolutely true. And as you said, the river cruising is a very different kind of experience. You know, you're on the boat for less periods of time and you actually cruise through the center of countries as opposed to sort of cruising around them.
I actually had the chance a few years ago to take an Avalon Waterways cruise through Europe. So it was about 6 days, I think, in Netherlands and Belgium. I was at a travel agency then, so it was a fam trip. But river cruising for me was a really relaxing way of seeing the country. It was a really different way of seeing the country. And yeah, I've really liked it. So I can see why it's becoming a more popular option here.
Yeah, I actually went on board one of the ships that plies plies the route from Yangon to Mandalay. And as you said, it was very small. It was beautifully designed. The cabins were extremely small, but the bar was beautiful. The bar was up on the top deck and had fabulous views. You can just imagine sort of going down the Irrawaddy. It would have been very atmospheric. I didn't actually manage to sail. I just had a look around it, but it was very, very nice. So, as always, we really enjoy reading your comments and thoughts on some of the issues that we discuss on the Southeast Asia Travel Show. And we put up a quick questionnaire on LinkedIn, and we'll read out some of the feedback in a few moments. But before we do so, Hannah, you reached out to a cruise expert, Lauren Rutherford, who is a senior manager of sustainable tourism in Wellington, New Zealand. And she studied cruise tourism development in Vanuatu for her master's degree. So some of her comments that she made were pretty illuminating.
Yes, so Lauren says, I suspect that there will be multiple impacts on the cruise sector. Air travel will not return to previous levels for some time, and it's likely many countries will keep tightened border restrictions in place for a long time. This is especially true of small island states whose maritime borders keep them safe. I am based in New Zealand at the moment, and I cannot see us opening our borders quickly or easily, as we have had great success in fighting the virus. Many Pacific nations, such as Vanuatu, popular with Australian-based cruisers, do not have identified cases of COVID-19 and also have highly vulnerable populations. They may not reopen their borders to mass tourism until there is a proven vaccine. Personally, I would love to see a power shift between destination countries and cruise companies. For too long, cruise has traded on the myth that the onshore passenger spend is more than enough to justify what it takes from small island countries. I would like to see more countries pushing back on things like passenger tax, embarkation fees, and enforcing creating environmental impact regulations.
There's a lot of food for thought there. Thanks very much, Lauren. Some fascinating points, especially the one about a vaccine, which obviously is a really, really white hot topic at the moment. In terms of, in future, will we actually have to be vaccinated before we're able to travel? That's an issue that's been postulated by the Schengen region in Europe. But we don't know about a vaccine. We don't know how close we are to actually having a vaccine, how it will work. There's no treatment at the moment. Testing, antibody testing, again, there seems to be a huge inconclusiveness about whether antibody testing actually works for people who have actually had the disease or maybe asymptomatic. Yeah. So there's so many issues to cover there. But obviously, for people getting on board a cruise ship, there will have to be some degree of testing and ability to know who's getting on board the ship at any one time.
Yes, and I think it's also about protecting the destinations that you're visiting. And I think that's similar to what Stuart from Travelfish was saying on our podcast a couple of episodes ago. Sure, you can go and travel, but are you going to be harming the country more than you're bringing good if you're carrying this virus to them?
So the next comment that we got was from Kel Willis, who's a creative marketing and sales chief for luxury charter vessels. Hi, Kel. says, whilst I think long term the traditional cruise industry will still be popular, COVID-19 and the irresponsible behavior of some large cruise operators will result in dwindling numbers. River cruises, which we just spoke about, however, will flourish. Not only are these much smaller and great for promoting local employment, that's a good point, they enable travelers to explore at a slower pace from different angles. Excellent points. Thank you very much, Gal.
Yes, and I think slow travel is definitely something that is finally going to take the limelight in 2020 and 21. A comment from Kristin Thorsteins, who's a VP at Club Med South and East Asia and Pacific, says, cruise tourism was already under fire before the COVID-19 crisis, which I think has merely accelerated an unavoidable evolution. I do, however, agree with you that there is an opportunity in smaller, less polluting liners that could help discover less trodden paths.
Another good point. Another very good point. Natasha Martin, who's an adventure tourism developer and tourism researcher in Cambodia, says, I think we all kind of expected that cruise wouldn't survive, but now there are a bunch of articles saying that cruise sales are up. I think that most people are tempted by the low prices and have enough confidence in cruise companies to make them safe when they set sail after the crisis is over.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I know that Natasha is taking quite a positive view about tourism recovery post-COVID.
Well, it's nice to be positive at the moment. There's so much gloom and doom around us.
Absolutely. I'm digging all of that positivity at the moment. Providing a counterpoint to that positivity is Aslan Jamil, who's COO at Drizzle Engineering, who says there will definitely be changes in how people view cruise vacation post-COVID-19. This is the time for tourism-related businesses to strategize and readjust their business model. Easier said than done, but a must nevertheless.
Yeah, that's a good point. And last but by no means least is Mohanid Salah, who's a digital business strategist in Dubai. And he says, I believe that this will be amongst the tourism forms most hardly hit. With the increasing numbers of millennial and Gen Z tourists, I would say that the focus will most definitely probably shift to experiential, more affordable and green tourism, none of which are offered by any form of cruise tourism. Yeah, interesting point. So that brings us almost to the end of this edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show, Hannah.
Yes, so as a reminder, our new weekly mini briefing email newsletter is free to sign up for. It goes out every Friday, and we take a look at one Southeast Asian country per week. Our first issue assessed the unfolding situation in the Philippines. Last week we covered Singapore. This week we ask, how can Indonesia reboot its tourism sector?
Big question. And as an extra bonus, subscribers also receive the free monthly cheat sheet, which is a concise roundup of the month's key developments in travel and tourism across the region. You can take a look at our January, February and March cheat sheets, which are on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com. And our April edition will be published next week.
Yeah, wow. Already end of April. In the meantime, please send us your comments and insights by email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com. Or you can drop us a message via Facebook at the SEA Travel Show, Twitter at SEA Travel Show, or via our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yep, and you can also follow us on Instagram at SEA Travel Show, where we regularly post colourful images from our travels across Southeast Asia.
So that's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to peruse the 2020 cruise catalogues. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Bye-bye.